One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Shepherd's Bush Green on the Uxbridge Road, W12. Three roads east of the killing of Katerina Konyeva. One road south of where Reg Christie euthanized his dog. One road west of the home of the Devil's Child. And just a few doors down from Bad Billy. Coming soon to Murder Mile. As a once affluent shopping district, Shepherd's Bush Green is now... ugh. As the mark of how far it has fallen, being that every shop either sells hair extensions, flavoured vapes, second-hand phones, which are mostly nicked, and a plethora of puke-inducing takeaways. All of which are deep-fried and slathered in a factory-produced sauce, as they're too disgusting to eat sober and barely palatable to scoff when you're drunk. At 122 Uxbridge Road currently stands Select Chicken. That's select with a K, not a C. Because as we all know, proving that you don't even have the basic literacy skills of a 3-year-old is cool. Back in 1980, this was the Shoebox. A pleasant little cobbler's shop, which had been ran for almost a decade by 75-year-old Nathaniel Taylor and his nephew, 55-year-old Leonard Mintz. As locals, they were a big part of the community. They were well-liked, and financially, their business was doing okay. But one afternoon, both men were brutally gunned down in the shop by two hoodlums in their early 20s, who were on a 19-day crime spree of theft, torture, and murder. And yet, unlike these boys' earlier crimes, this double murder wasn't committed within a few streets of their East London homes. But why? My name is Michael. I'm your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 253, The Shoebox Killer, Part 1. Mickey was an enigma. Michael Thomas Jameson was born in West Ham in East London on the 5th of September 1957, as one of 11 children in a hectic working-class brood. Described as a mummy's boy, being a baby-faced little cherub with light brown hair and bright green eyes, Mikey was an angel to his siblings, his pals, his girlfriend, his son, and especially his beloved mother Shirley. But to everyone else, he was a devil. Little was reported about his upbringing, but with his father being an inmate at Broadmoor Psychiatric Hospital, a high-security prison for some of Britain's most disturbed criminals, it was said he'd begun thieving as a child because he was hungry. Although how much of that was true is debatable. Being in trouble with the police before he was even into his teens, with a history of theft, burglary and assault, His very limited education was received in borstals, detention centres and approved schools, where he should have learned how to become a decent human being. But instead, he only learned how to be bad. Assessed before his trial for multiple counts of murder, Dr. Henry Rollin described 23-year-old Mickey Jameson as a born psychopath, as he didn't have any of the characteristics of a civilized member of society, at least not to anyone he cared about. As he abused alcohol, he hated work, he struggled to form lasting relationships, and towards the other people, he was aggressive, cruel, and remorseless. For Mickey the wannabe thug, nothing was worth working for. Everything was his for the taking. Life was about having fun, and he didn't give a damn who got hurt, injured, or killed in his pursuit of money. In 1974, age 17, recently released from Borstal, which is a failed experiment into rehabilitation of criminals, was just a few years away from being shut down. Mickey met Kay Elms, when she said, "We were little more than just kids," and moved into a rented flat together in Canning Town, not far from his mum's house. This was his world. His mum's house, his flat, his pals, his pub, and his beloved West Ham Football Club. His community consisted of a few streets around Plaistow and West Ham, with occasional seaside trips to Clacton-on-Sea and towns like Stratford and Romford. But not being best blessed with brains, it was also the places he would steal from and the people he would terrorise. Living with Kay, his common law wife. In 1976, they had a son together who they named Edward. With Kay stating, he doted on the boy and couldn't have treated him better. And although a caring dad, he was far from a good father. As Kay recalled, he never worked. He just played pool and watched footy. He loved his son. But whereas some dads get their children's names tattooed upon their skin, on his right arm, Mickey was marked with the quincunx, a square of four dots representing the four corners of a prison cell, and a single dot in the centre representing himself behind bars. He had ruined his life before it had even begun. But rather than focusing on something good, all he thought about was being bad. Mickey was a brutal thug who was hell-bent on a crime spree. Only he wouldn't or couldn't do it alone. His accomplice was 25-year-old James Anderson, known as Jimmy, a childhood friend who looked equally as fresh-faced and innocent, with brown-cropped hair, blue eyes, and as criminals do to ensure that they're easily caught, a tattoo of his name Jim and his girlfriend Lynn on his left wrist. Like twins separated at birth, who enjoyed drinking and promiscuity. Although Jimmy would profess his innocence in court over the murders, it should have come as no surprise to him, having described Mickey as a nutter, just plain evil, who'd do outrageous things without any regard for anyone else. The motive for their 19-day spree of theft, robbery, murder and torture remains uncertain. It was suggested Mickey had been drinking heavily. As Kay would say, "People won't believe me, but he is a nice person. Only he changes for the worse when he's had a few drinks." Another reason was 2 months earlier, Kay and Mickey had split. And although she was seeing someone else, he always had other women, so our break in July was not unexpected. maybe with him, due to attend Snaresbrook Crown Court on charges of theft on Tuesday the 9th of September 1980, was his reason. Wanting to have one last gangbang of wanton violence before he was locked away for a few months in Chokey. Or perhaps, these are all just feeble excuses for a psychopath with some seriously bad wiring. The first crime in their 19-day spree took place on the night of Friday the 29th of August, 1980. Barely 1 mile west of his mother's home, 2 miles shy of his Canning Town flat, and a 5-minute walk from West Ham's Upton Park Stadium. Armed with a gun he'd bought off a bloke down his local boozer, Mickey and Jimmy broke into the unoccupied home of Samuel Tucker on Thackeray Road. Gaining entry by breaking a window, scattering like rats from room to room in search of goodies, they rifled the drawers for cash and jewellery, swiping £650 worth, roughly £3,500 worth today. And being the two of them, they carried out a nearly new 28-inch colour television, weighing as much as a large dog. Fleeing like rabid flies, lured to a fresher shit being squeezed out of an incontinent dog's arsehole, both lads cackled, having made a sizable score. Some might say it was an innocent crime as no one was injured or shot. But as these two selfish turds stained a family home with a perpetual sense of fear that they'd be attacked again, they also pawned off the owner's irreplaceable personal possessions. Some might also say he did it just to feed his kids. But did this money go to their kids? No. That night, as the Tucker family wept, these two arrogant tossers headed to Snob's Disco in Stratford, a lowbrow nightclub where the East End's hippest undesirables, boogied in bright red body warmers, caused a fire hazard in spandex and an obstruction owing to their Disney-style shoulder pads. All while grooving to Win It Takes It All by ABBA, Love Will Tear Us Apart by the Joy Division, a pirate copy of Baggy Trousers by Madness, and all having splashed out on Lambrini, Baby Sham, Blue Nun, and a few cans of Skull Lager. Having done their heist around the time of the club's opening, they got drunk, splashed the cash, Frenchied some girls, having got them squiffy on Buck's Fizz, and generally acted like a bunch of Billy Big Bollocks. They didn't care about their victims. All they cared about was having fun. And although 650 quid was a big score, by the morning, they spent the lot. The next day, another life would be sullied by their cruelty. Only this isn't a story about hardened criminals who were feared, respected, and only attacked rivals who stepped on their turf. This is about two selfish cowards who only attacked the weak, the old, the lonely, the vulnerable, and the helpless. Saturday the 30th of August 1980, comprised of another crime to fund another weekend of fun. Mickey and Jimmy sat in a pub in Plaistow, nursing several pints of Kestrel until their pennies were spent. As although they dreamed of being feared, these turgid terrors could do diddly squat while they were sober. Last time, they burgled an empty home. This time, these utter cowards targeted the most defenseless. 78-year-old Catherine Herbert, and her husband, 75-year-old Joseph, were a well-loved couple who'd recently celebrated their golden wedding anniversary. In their 50 years together, Kitty and Joe had seen off sickness, disease, infirmity, strikes, recessions, and a world war. They had witnessed happiness and hardship. But they were always by each other's side, holding hands, and enjoying the well-deserved twilight of their years. Neighbors said of them, they were as devoted to each other as the day they were married. But as old age had made them weaker, it also made them the target for the morally feeble. A year earlier, their home on New Barn Street in Plaistow was burgled and £100 was taken. As a loving son who would do anything to protect his aged parents, 34-year-old Michael, who worked at Scotland Yard's information room, had fitted a new UPVC door with deadbolts and toughened glass. It was a smart decision by a good son for the right reasons. But it had just one weakness. The Herbert's home wasn't chosen at random, as having left the pub, Nicky and Jimmy headed to the pensioner's home they had robbed just 1 year before, knowing that Joe and Kitty would be weak, asleep, and helpless. At a little after 2 a.m, along this busy road of two-story terraces, through the large living room window, they spotted that the lights were off, the curtains were closed, and the occupants were upstairs snoozing. There were no witnesses to the crime, but we know it occurred at just before 2:15 a.m. Mickey knocked on the door. It took a little while for Joe to stir from his sleep. But as many of us would do, still being a little bit groggy and not thinking straight, he went to the door and unlocked it. Dressed in just his pajamas, before Joe could see who it was, Mickey's fist slammed fast into his face, breaking his nose, fracturing his eye socket, and disorientating the old man as he was pushed inside. And with the door locked and the curtains closed, none of their sleeping neighbours were any the wiser. Once inside, regardless of their age or infirmity, Mickey started punching them, demanded to know where the money was. As Jimmy said, he was going crazy, saying there must be bundles stashed away. And as he tore the watch from Joe's wrist and smashed it, the hand stopped at exactly 2:15 a.m. Slumped on the floor, terrified and bleeding, Jimmy would later claim, Mickey acted like an animal. And with every drawer searched, every cupboard flung open, and its contents scattered, still insistent that they had money stashed away, he would hurt them in a multitude of cruel and inhuman ways. But first, he would attack their faithful friend. From its cage, Mickey grabbed their budgie. As fitting snugly in his fist, he held this 35-gram bird. Demanding once more,
where's the money?
It squawked a last painful squawk, as with his fingers tightening tighter, the budgie's bones were crushed like toothpicks. It was a warning to Joe and Kitty, as the broken body of their faithful feathered friend was tossed at their bare feet. In court, Jimmy Anderson would claim,
"I left around then,"
leaving them alone with a sadistic psychopath. Having ransacked the house, whether he knew or didn't believe that he'd taken every penny they had, just £70, about £370 today, he subjected the Herberts to a long and painful torture, maybe for pleasure. Dragging these petrified pensioners upstairs and into separate bedrooms, using ripped strips of his pajamas and leaving Joe in just his underwear, he bound their hands and ankles. He tied them each to a bed, and with this devoted couple unable to see each other, as he maliciously sliced and stabbed at their flesh, even as a pillow muffled their screams, they could still hear each other's cries of pain. Until around 6:30 a.m., having endured almost 4 hours of terror and torture, with the dawn light well and truly risen, the sadist brutally stabbed Joe in the stomach and Kitty in her chest. Fleeing the house, with a pittance in his pocket, he smashed a wall clock in anger, which, like the wristwatch, stopped the hands at exactly 6:32 a.m., giving an accurate bookend to his night of sadistic fun. A pathologist would state,
"The couple may have survived for up to an hour after being stabbed."
And yet, tied to separate beds, gagged, bleeding, and weak, as the street outside awoke and the neighbours went about their days, no one was due to visit them, and no one knew that they were dying. As happens, those who knew them thought it was odd that they hadn't seen them since Friday afternoon, but they didn't alert the police. A neighbour, Anne Hurd, assumed, "I thought they'd gone on holiday." But it wasn't until 5 days later, when their milk bottles started piling up, that a milkman alerted the police. Notifying their son, on Thursday the 4th of September 1980, the bodies of Kitty and Joe were found, bound, gagged, stabbed, and tortured. Having died one room apart, their beloved budgie crushed and dumped. For the sake of barely a week's wage, Michael Jameson had perpetrated what Judge Miskin QC would describe as one of the most revolting, loathsome killings ever. With Detective Chief Superintendent Ron Hay stating,
"We are looking for someone sick. We are looking for a very vicious animal."
It was a murder so horrific, it haunted the nightmares of those who investigated it. But Mickey Jameson didn't give a shit. Later calling at the Canningtown flat he shared with his girlfriend, Kay Elms, she said, "He appeared very drunk and collapsed on the settee, as if for the first time in his life, he'd done a hard day's work. I saw he had some dried blood on his foot. He said he'd been in a fight the previous night and said,
'Some geezer and I were stabbing a man. I stabbed a bird and all. She was lying on the floor, making a choking noise, and I was laughing.'"
Which sums up his attitude to the robbery, the torture, and the murders. That day was the last day he would return to his flat, his wife, and his son. As not being the smartest, His fingerprints are all over the Herberts' house. They were also on police file. He had a history of burglary and assault. And like an idiot, he almost always committed his crimes on his own doorstep. Before he ran, he lied to Kay to provide himself an alibi, stating,
"If anyone asks, I was at Snob's Disco until after 2:15 a.m.
It being no coincidence that this was the time that Joe Herbert's smashed watch had stopped at. Later insisting,
"I then came home and spent the rest of the night with you."
Only when she was asked, being a decent person and a good mum with a young boy to consider, rightly, she told the truth. Over the next 5 days, Mickey and Jimmy laid low, hiding out in hostels and sleeping on sofas, trying not to be spotted. Especially as, on Thursday the 5th of September, the local papers were plastered with "Couple Murdered in Plasto," which shook the neighbourhood to its core and erupted into suspicious whispers. Being wanted men, who it wouldn't be a struggle to identify, they should have gone into hiding. But with Friday the 5th of September being Mickey's birthday, like a self-absorbed twerp, all he wanted was to get boozed up and boogie. But once again, he was broke. That day, barely half a mile from the Herberts' home, they broke into the unoccupied house of John Davies on High Street North in East Ham. Taking £260, roughly £1,400 today, they could have used their ill-gotten gains to flee. But he wanted cake, he wanted booze, and he wanted a boogie. But he didn't care who got hurt, as long as he had his fill. And around the same time that the Herberts were being autopsied, he was partying hearty at Snob's Disco. Until once again, the cash ran out. On Monday the 8th of September 1980, 9 days into their 19-day crime spree, having committed 3 burglaries and a double murder all within streets of each other, like rats scurrying from a fetid sewer, they were seeking an easy feast and had made the decision to rob a post office on Catherine Street in East Ham. Had Jimmy been as innocent as he claimed to be, after the murder, he'd have ran. Only he didn't. In court, Judge Miskin QC stated,
"When you looked at post offices to rob, there were too many people in some of them for you brave boys to manage."
So along this bustling street, they chose to rob a newsagent and sub-post office of 42-year-old Champakal Bagwandas Gandhi, also known as Sebi. Again, like idiots, the street was a place they were all well known. Being too lazy to go any further, as that required some effort, these hopeless hoodlums wanted quick cash, fast fun, and were allergic to work. Armed with a pistol he'd purloined off a Ponce in a local pub, Mickey, Jimmy, and one other, said to be their equally as pathetic pal, John Hamilton, they sidled into the empty post office. Behind the counter, Sebi was by himself. But having been robbed many times before, when they entered, he barely blinked. But it wasn't that Sebi was fearless and willing to stand up to them, which ruined their day. As being drunk, what Mickey had forgotten was this. Sebi knew him. like a little boy, bragging that he was now wearing big pants rather than pampers. Mickey hadn't twigged that by robbing a post office in the area where he'd grown up, that Sibby had known him since he was a kid. He knew his name, his home, his mother, his father, his siblings, and his criminal ways. Slurring his words, as he'd drunk several pints of beer to drum up enough courage to be a petty thief and a pathetic waste of space, Mickey pulled the pistol from his pocket and pointed it at the sub-postmaster, just 6 inches from his chest. But as he demanded the money from the till, Sebby just laughed, cackling,
"You must be kidding, Mickey."
Realizing he was screwed, Sebby was shot in the heart at point-blank range. And as he slumped hard to the floor, like vultures, the boys ransacked his hard-earned cash from the till and then fled. In total, they got away with £560, barely £1,000 each, which wouldn't even last them a few more nights of fun. All three of them had wasted their lives. But one person who hadn't was Sebby's surgeon, as although the bullet had entered his heart, the postmaster made a full recovery and gave the police descriptions of all three men, including their names. Again, Jimmy would deny he had anything to do with the attempted murder of the postmaster. And whereas Mickey would brag about it to his ever-decreasing circle of friends. The net was closing in on Mickey Jameson. He was on the run. He was a wanted man. And soon, in need of some quick cash, in a place where his face wasn't known, he headed 12 and a half miles west to Shepherd's Bush Green, bringing murder to a little shop called the Shoebox. The concluding part of The Shoebox Killer continues next week.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Good. That wasn't terrible. That wasn't terrible. You take your little hat off. There we go, folks. Hope you're all good. I might put my little hat on. Might have taken your hat off, putting my hat on. Because having a baldy, baldy bonce, I get cold very quickly. So anyway, I hope you're all well and doing good. I'm on the mend, it seems. I think almost all of my mucus has gone. I've spent the last few weeks just staring at a chart of mucus and then hacking up, going, making horrible hacking sounds, and then looking into my tissue and going, that's the stage of my bronchitis. Anyway, almost there now, almost done. I've got a couple of weeks of this annoying tickly cough and buggered up lungs. But apart from that, getting there slowly. So that's all good. I'm not going to make a cup of tea because I've still got a herbal tea on the go. I'm going to have to go back on my diet because I've been out of action almost since November. November when my back started playing up again and then my toe started playing up. Oh, I'm falling apart. Jeez. And then the bronchitis kicked in. It's, what is it? I don't know what day it is now. When is it now? I'm not super far ahead of you, but I'm close. It's the 30th of April today. So happy birthday, War Hero. It's my mate War Hero. It's his birthday today. 30th. Yeah, I've been out of action for ages, and I'm going on holiday soon. I know, holiday. So I need to lose some weight, so I don't look like a big old bouncing beach ball bouncing along the beach. That would be the worst thing, wouldn't it? Me walking along the beach wearing me budgie smugglers, and then someone tries to pick me up and throw me to their pals so they can play beach volleyball, and then I end up crushing some kids. It does happen. It does happen. So, especially as this is an all-inclusive holiday. We've been there before. All the food is you would think with an all-inclusive food holiday that the food would be a bit shit, but I have to say every single meal was excellent. It was really good, so I'm gonna pig out like a massive big old oink oink. So there we go. Oh dear, ruptured a muscle in my stomach from coughing too much. Anyway, this is Extra Mile, the unscripted, unedited bit, a little bit of a waffle. We have some quiz questions, we dive into some extra stuff about the episode, and then I'm probably going to try and go for a walk in a bit. I had a couple of days where I couldn't go out. Almost 10 days of not being able to go outside because of bronchitis. So I've gone a bit spacey crazy. I'll admit to that. Anyway, what else is going on? Don't forget, if you're in South Shields on the 2nd of June, I think it's a Sunday, me, Paul from UK True Crime, Adam from True Crime. No, other way around. Me, Paul from True Crime Enthusiast, Adam from UK True Crime are doing a live show called... what have we called it? I think we've called it Murder Ain't Easy. Yeah, we've called it Murder Ain't Easy. So we're only doing... it's a one-off. We just want to give it a go. Come along, have some fun. If it goes well, we might do some more. If not, we'll just wrap it up. Something important happened this week. If you go back to episode 76, it was a story of a young boy, 12-year-old boy, called Diego Pinheiro Villa. He was... stabbed 30 times in, it was on South Dials in Covent Garden, by a Satanist paedophile called Edward Crowley. This happened not too many years ago. This is only about 20 years ago. Obviously, all of his young friends are all grown up now. The Edward Crowley is up for parole soon. Which obviously they're quite worried about, given the fact that this guy's not only he had multiple counts of being a grooming paedophile and a multiple child and a child killer. So they've set up a petition. Obviously, you can only sign this petition if you're in the United Kingdom, unfortunately, because that's the way I think it does. But they're trying to get 10,000 signatures, and what they want to do is they want to have for child murderers, they want a mandatory 30-year sentence with no possibility of early parole, because as you know, in this country and many countries as well, you kind of they say, you're going to make sure that you have 30 years, and then like 5 years down the line they go, okay, well it's time for parole because the prisons are full. But if someone's a sadistic paedophile and a child murderer, there should be a mandatory 30-year sentence before parole is even considered. So Anyway, let's do some quiz questions. 10 quiz questions. And then we'll do some extra stuff in the episode. So let's see what you remember. Question number one. What is the name of the shop that now stands in place of the shoebox? Question number two. What was Mickey's middle name? Question number three. In which part of East London was he born? Question number four. What was his favourite football team? Question number five. His mother had how many children by the time of the murders? I'm not saying that the murders are connected to her mum, his mum having children. I'm just saying by the time he committed the murders, how many children did she have? Question number six. Where was his father when he was growing up? Question number seven. He lived with his girlfriend in which part of East London? Question number eight. Where did he sometimes go to the seaside? Question number nine. He had a son called what? That's not... He had a son. What was the son's name? Not he had a son called what? Full stop. He had a son called question mark. And question number 10. What tattoo did he have on his right arm? So let's dive into some of this stuff. Normally in an episode, I would do... I would refer to them by mostly their surnames. But it's kind of difficult on this one because Mikey is Michael and his surname is Jameson. But his childhood friend is James Anderson, who is also known as Jamie. And it just throws everything off with the names. So Jameson, Anderson, Jamie, James... It just threw everything off. So because everyone called them Mickey and Jimmy, I just felt that was an easier way of separating them out in your head rather than, you know, Anderson, Jameson. It just makes everything a lot more difficult. So normally I wouldn't use first names, but for them I've had to in this case. His description, baby-faced. He looks a lot younger than 23. He honestly does look like he's about 17. He's 5'6", slim build, dark complexion, light brown short hair, green eyes, with a scar on his right hand and a mole on his left cheek, and of course a tattoo, which is one of our quiz questions. That was part of the description that was given later on. You'll learn about that in part two. This is going to be weird for me because again, I wrote both episodes back to back, and now I'm recording. Then I've gone back to recording the first one, so I already know where we've got to. And now my brain is going, hang on, what bit does what bit happen? He was described as a mummy's boy, said to be an angel to his mother and some of his siblings, but a devil to everyone else. Elms was his girlfriend. He'd been with her for about 6 years. They were technically common law husband and wife. By the age of the time of the murder, they got a 4-year-old son. Kay said he doted on the boy and couldn't have treated him better. We met 6 years ago. We were only 17 years old, so not much more than kids. And they had a child at the age of 19. She said he had a very nice personality, but it still was just a couple of weeks after meeting that we started living together. Mickey used to spend his spare time playing pool and watching football. He never worked. Maybe that's the thing. Maybe if he would have got a job and committed himself to something like that, he wouldn't have gone off to do criminal stuff. I always find that fascinating with criminals, that they always go for that excuse to go, I got kids, so I got to feed my kids, and all that. You just go, yeah, but that's the problem, isn't it? Like, a good parent would go out and work hard and earn money to feed and clothe their children, because all the time they're knowing that they go to work, they do a job. It may not pay particularly well. Do you know what? Crime doesn't pay particularly well. I know we sometimes read things in here like they stole, they did a burglary and they did, you know, they made earned £1,000. But you'll see throughout the rest of this episode, they just burn through money too fast because the money doesn't go on that on the family or on important things. It's, you know, this selfishness.
So yeah, if he would have got a regular job, he could have come home every night, could have seen his child. I think that's the problem with a lot of criminals, is they claim that they're in it to, got to feed the wife and kids, got to pay the mortgage, like that, all that bullshit. But you know full well it's all about themselves, it's all about being a gangster, it's all about reputation. It's just bollocks, it really is. Oh, little rat coming past again. Someone just down from here has a rat on a string. Not a proper dog, a rat. What else we got? Education was limited, as mentioned. Never had a job, as far as we know. Described as, they were both of broken homes and were in trouble with the police before they were into their teens. excuse me. Mikey was said to have begun stealing as a child because he was hungry, and also so he could get clothes and shoes for school. I have to leave out that bit because that's a quiz question. And he spent most of his younger years in Borstal detention centres and approved schools. I think I've put in there that Borstals was something that we kind of had up until, I think it was 82 or 83, it was shut down. And the idea was it was meant to be a rehabilitation place, but if you've watched films like Scum, detention centres, Borstal's really didn't work, and actually quite a few of the kids said that they would go in there having committed minor thefts, and they'd come out with a greater knowledge of crime, and having hung around with people who, that's what they did. Motivation for the crime, we really don't know what kind of led him for this. It's kind of a weird one, isn't it? Because it's like, it's not like he's young, it's not like there's a deadline approaching. He and his girlfriend had split, but he's cheating on her, she's seeing someone else. There's apparently the split up in the February before, and the split up in the July, so it happened a lot. So I think for some people you could say that would be the motivation to be angry and go on a spree. But, as we've seen, he's out in the town, he's chatting up girls. In part two, I kind of took out a bit. There's something that's referenced in there, but, he is seeing other girls around the time. Dr. Henry Rollin, who assessed him before it went to trial, said that he was a born psychopath, displaying irresponsibility, aggressiveness, abuse of alcohol, disenchantment of work, inability to form lasting relationships, and he was incapable of remorse. Which definitely comes across in especially the murder of the Herberts. We're not really too sure why he decided that he had to do this with his pal Jimmy. Jimmy was 25. He was living on Hammersley Avenue in Woolwich at the time, although he was kind of grew up in and around the same area that Mickey did. What else we got? I'm going to read you that quote here that it said from Jimmy himself. Obviously, this you have to take it into context, don't you? You can read someone's quote, but then again, you have to remember the context that they'd said in. And when we get to part two, when you learn about the court case and kind of all things like that, this kind of makes more sense why Jimmy would say this. But he would say of his friend Mickey, he's a nutter, just plain evil. He would do outrageous things on the spur of the moment and without any regard for anyone else. I've kind of hinted at that here, but we kind of learn a lot more about this when we get into part two. James Anderson, a.k.a. Jamie, also known as Jimmy, slightly taller, 5'10", slim with dark brown cropped hair, fresh complexion and blue eyes, a little bit horsey-faced. That wasn't one of the official descriptions. He had a scar on his first finger on his left hand, because as we all know, all criminals have to have scars, it's essential, and a tattoo of Jim and Lynn on his left wrist. Which is, I always find that baffling when you see people who are criminals and they get arrested and they've either got stupid tattoos and you just go, Really, that's why don't you put a tattoo of your fucking fingerprint on your face and have done with it? Or on your forehead, why don't you put your name and your address and your telephone number so that when the CCTV comes past, they can go, oh, that's him. Just bellend. I think that's the problem, is they don't think. They don't have brain power. They don't think. They don't think to themselves, they think, oh, I will get me a nice tattoo. It will look good. I like it. Look, Whereas, you know, if you're going to go and commit crimes, you want to make sure that you're not going to be spotted. Therefore, don't make it too easy. But they don't think about that because they're fucking idiots. As mentioned with the Herberts, there was a prior robbery at the Herberts' home. It was about a year before. Therefore, their son had put in £100 was taken. That was roughly £530 today. So not a massive amount of money, but you know, for these guys, enough to last them a weekend. Was this Mickey and Jimmy? It was said in court that it was proven that they had broken in a year earlier, but we don't really know too much information about that. I'll be honest with this case. All of the police and court stuff is still locked away. We won't get to touch it until 2080. So I've had to use every kind of other source that I would use to try and piece together this story. One of those cases that I always wanted to cover, but I just never really had the... I thought without the police files, I wouldn't be able to do it as fully as I wanted to. But when I started going through all my research, I realised there was enough at this moment to do a two-parter. If we ever get access to those files, which we won't, you could probably do a three-parter on it, but not much more. I had another Freedom of Information request rejected today. Oh, so annoying. All these murders from the 1940s that I've said, it's 80 years on, more than 80 years on. Surely it's time to release these files, and unfortunately, they have to do a test on them all, or with kind of the families who are still out there and the police who worked on the case, or you know, lawyers and things like that. And sometimes they get released and sometimes they don't. What else have we got? We don't know the address of the Herberts. I know it was on New Barn Street. New Barn Street is quite big. But we don't know exactly what the house was. We know what it looks like. We know roughly where it was, but we don't know where it was. But this is the kind of the interesting thing with all of these murders. You would think being a murderer, like with Jack the Shitter, that episode we did, he deliberately made sure that the attacks didn't happen. I'm not praising him in his brilliance, because he's not. He's a tit. But he deliberately made sure that he didn't commit any of the attacks in an area where he was known, which I would say makes sense. Whereas these guys are just fucking idiots. Like, when you look at it, all of the crimes that they commit on their spree, and this is not including the other crimes that they may have committed, are all within the areas that they know. That, unfortunately, like a lot of criminals, they're really bloody lazy. They can't be asked to get off their arse. They're just like, that looks like a shop, and it's probably got money, we'll go in there. And as seen at the final part of this episode, they end up robbing a place where the person knows them by name. Utter turds. Utter idiotic turds. Unfortunately, as it turned out, it was an elderly couple, lived together for years, both retired. Parents of PC Michael Herbert, who worked at Scotland Yard's information room. He'd already fitted a really solid, decent door. It was the early days of UPVC. So prior to that, it would have been a wooden door. This was a good, strong, sturdy door. Do you know, he'd splashed out to make sure it was good. Obviously, it's his parents. He wanted to do right by them. John Hamilton, who's mentioned in the attack on the Sub Post Office. It is uncertain whether John Hamilton took part in the Herbert's murder. So Jimmy said he's... See, this is the problem with Jimmy. Jimmy likes to make claims. Oh, I had nothing to do with it. I was only in it for the money. I wasn't there for the murders. And you'll see that throughout. We keep coming back to that. But he said when he left, and he said that was roughly after the budgerigar was crushed. He said he'd been at the house with two others. And that he was quite upset. He said that Mickey was acting like an animal and therefore he left. But he doesn't say, in the details that we've got, it'll be in the court records, but we don't have it here. It doesn't say who those other two people were. And it doesn't say expressly whether John Hamilton was part of this this attack as well. So it's all very complicated. I'm not going to rehash all the details of the attack on the elderly couple. Apparently they got away with just £70, which is roughly £370 today. And we know the timings of that murder because obviously he smashed the watch. So stupid, isn't it? Smashing a watch on the way in and then smashing a wall clock on the way out. I know he's an angry bellend and he's got no brain in his head. He's got not a single brain cell. But it's effectively like he's clocking into work, isn't it? He clocks in at 2:15, he clocks out at 6:32 a.m. What a fucking idiot. Oh, just absolutely, absolutely crazy. What else have we got? As mentioned in the episode, he bragged to his girlfriend about the murder. He didn't exactly say he went round an old people's home, but another friend was there at the time, so... he went back to see his girlfriend Kay. Her friend Colleen Turpin was there. Colleen said, "I saw he had dried blood on his feet. He said he'd been in the fight the night before and said some geezer and I were stabbing a man. I stabbed a bird and all. She was lying on the floor and making a choking noise and I was laughing." Kay had said he appeared very drunk and collapsed on the settee. He said he'd been in a fight with a couple of persons and had stabbed a man and the woman was screaming, so he hit her. And obviously he's using the alibi here of saying to her, "Oh, if anyone speaks, I was at Snob's Disco until 2:15 a.m. which is kind of ironic because that's exactly the same time as Joe's watch. Although that's odd, isn't it? If he knew that the watch had stopped at 2:15, why didn't he take the watch? Why didn't he take the watch and destroy it? Why did he leave it behind? Why did he smash the wall clock, leaving behind a kind of an idea of when he finished? Just utter turd. No, let's not forget, not wearing a disguise, not planning it, being a bit drunk in advance. Just this continues throughout this whole thing. And you'll see that they're both absolute fucking idiots. But there we go. I hope I've made my feelings clear on that. Fucking idiots. They really are. So let's do quiz questions. Question number one. What shop now stands in the place of the shoebox? It's Select Chicken. Select with a K, because it's cool. Question number two. What was Mickey's middle name? His full name was Michael Thomas Jameson, so it was Thomas. Question number three, in which part of East London was he born? West Ham. Question number four, what was his favourite football team? Come on, the answer was in the previous question, it's West Ham. Question number five, his mother had how many children at the time of the murders? Oh, it was 11. Bloody hell. Question number six, where was his father when he was growing up? He was an inmate at Broadmoor Psychiatric Hospital. Question number seven, he lived with his girlfriend in which part of East London? That's Canning Town. Question number eight, where did he sometimes go to the seaside? Clacton-on-Sea. Question number nine, he had a son called what? Edward. And question number ten... What tattoo did he have on his right arm? It was a quincunx, which is a square of four dots representing the corners of a prison cell and a single dot at the centre representing himself behind bars. Because as you all know, it's always great to remind yourself of the shit times that you've had as opposed to having a tattoo on yourself, which reminds you of something more positive or maybe a nicer future, as opposed to thinking about the past and... shite like that. Anyway, there you go, folks. Hope you enjoyed that. That was part one of two. So part two next week. And I think that's it. I'm going to do a little bit of an edit. And then I'm going to go... What time is it? It's 2 o'clock. And then I'm going to go on a bit of a walk. A little bit of exercise. That'd be nice. So hope you're having a good one. Have a good week. Thank you for supporting the show. It's very much appreciated. Stay safe. Be good. Lots of love, everyone.
Bye. If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.